And now to the overcrowded, hot and complex Kakuma refugee camp in Africa for some good news, yes, good news, of people just getting on with it, making their lives better. Years ago, when I was immigration minister, I did go to a couple of refugee camps, but not to Kakuma in Africa. There are various reasons for that that aren't important. But we're now about to talk to Zan Rice, who's a freelance writer based in Oxford, about the myth of dependency. You can get a view about refugee camps that everyone there is just standing in line, waiting for the rice to be handed out, and not see the creativity and enterprise that can be there. So I'm very pleased now to talk to Zan Rice. Zan, welcome to Counterpoint.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me.
What were you doing in Kakuma?
So I lived in Kenya from 2004 to 2011. I was a correspondent for the Times newspaper of London and later for The Guardian. So I actually visited refugee camps throughout the region in Congo, Somalia, Ethiopia, various places. And one of the places I went to was Kakuma, in northwest Kenya. And I went on assignment for Inside Story in Australia just to see what was going on at the camp. At the time I went in 2008, a lot of the camp inhabitants who were mainly from Sudan, South Sudan, were thinking about going home. So I was looking at the future of the camp at that time.
And what did you find? I mean, I know that it started off as a not very large town, something like a trading post, and then there was this tremendous explosion of people.
That's right. In 1991, there was nothing in Kakuma. It was a little village, really, 7,000 semi-nomadic Turkana people. The following year, 16,000 South Sudanese children came across through Ethiopia due to the war there and in Sudan. And suddenly, this refugee camp just began to mushroom. And by the time I got there in 2008, I think there was about 50,000 refugees. The numbers had gone down because some people had already gone back to Sudan. But it was still a vast, vast camp spread over, I think, 36 square kilometers. Perhaps not the camp that people would envisage, you know, white UN tents, emergency situation. These were mud huts, as I say, spread out over a very large distance and certainly a feeling of permanency there. It had already been a camp for 16 years by that stage.
And what did you notice in terms of what you might call entrepreneurial spirit in the camp?
Yeah, I mean, that was very clear from the second I set foot in the camp. As I said, people are living in these mud huts, but there's just little shops everywhere you go selling basic foodstuffs, pasta, rice, maize, powdered milk, sweets, that sort of thing. But barbershops, shops selling mobile phones or mobile phone airtime, anything you can think of. It wasn't just people sitting around passing the time. It was people hustling, people trying to make a little money to get by a little easier.
Even, I understand, shops selling the means to, you know, turn your light on at night.
Exactly, yeah. And there's no electricity provided in the camp. So all sorts of solar products, generators. Yeah, people being very, very creative in the products they source and the products they sell, you know, to meet what people want.
Now, that leads to the point that people, if they look at some refugee camps being like this, because they might not all be the same.
Yeah.
Seeing some vibrancy and saying, well, you know, how can we improve the lives of these people by taking that into account? And as I understand it, the International Finance Corporation has started to have a look at this. And see how the private sector might become involved. And I wondered if you had a view about the degree to which that's a good idea, will that get people out of the camps, or will it simply make, I'm not opposed to simply making the camps better, but is that all it will do? Or will getting the private sector in there, realising the market that is there that might attract them, actually maybe make a difference into getting people out of these camps?
Yeah, I think that's a tricky one. I think there's two things. I think the first thing is, how can you make the camps a better place? And by giving people more choice in terms of products, by introducing more competition, which will bring prices down, by giving the people opportunity to learn skills as traders or as employees or semi-employees of whatever companies come into trade, I think that's got to be a good thing, giving the refugees who are very entrepreneurial access to finance, microloans. We've seen elsewhere in the world, this is something which very much does work. People do pay back these small loans and get businesses off the ground. So I think that's a good thing. On the other side of it, by giving the data about these camps and about which areas, whether it's banking or whether it's electricity or just general goods, to the private sector and saying, hey guys, this is what refugees are spending their monies on, or these are the goods they could potentially spend their money on. Come on in, and there's opportunities here. That's a good thing. In terms of getting people out of the camps, that's a whole different thing, because then you're getting up to a government policy level. And generally with refugees at a country level, governments are loath to give refugees free movement throughout the country and come back or go and settle elsewhere in the country, the host country, should I say.
Sure.
So if conditions in South Sudan were better, Kakuma would be a far smaller camp. I mean, it may even not exist by now. Most of the people would go home. They're not staying there out of choice. But whether they could go elsewhere in Kenya or other so-called safe countries in the region, I think that's probably unlikely.
Mm. It's often forgotten. I don't know about the debate in the United Kingdom, but certainly here it's often forgotten that the best outcome for a genuine refugee is that they can in fact go home. That is the best outcome for them, that they go home and are not persecuted and live their life with their family and friends and, you know, enjoy life. That's what the refugee system was set up to do, give people protection in a situation where they can't go home. But can we just deal with the people in the camps? There are people there who were born there, who perhaps have got grandchildren there.
Yeah.
So they've had kids and they've seen their kids have kids. And that leads to the chance those people have of getting ahead if peace does return to their country such that they can go home, if they haven't had a decent education. So isn't that one of the most vital things you can provide in a camp, so that kids grow up, teenagers know that they've got a skill, that if they get out of the camp, they've got something to sell?
Yeah, exactly. That is the most crucial thing, because if, you know, if you've got someone who's 20 years old and has lived their whole life in Kakuma and has maybe had a few years of primary school, what chance are they going to have of thriving back in Sudan with all its problems? Not very much. And that is one of the great problems in Kakuma, and I suspect in many other refugee camps, is the education. According to the latest figures, I think there was 26,000 kids of school age in Kakuma alone who are not in school because of the lack of places, primarily the lack of teachers, the lack of facilities. That is a major problem. And when I was there in 2008 and people were thinking of going back to Sudan, one of the drivers for people was actually, well, is it going to be so bad there? Because we're not getting any secondary schooling here anyway. So maybe let's go back to Sudan, where there is a lot of aid pouring in and there is a lot of goodwill, and perhaps the chances will be better there.
Mm. Can I come back to one other point you said about what might be a good thing about getting the private sector in? And one of the things you said was the camp residents having, you know, more choice in terms of products they can get.
Yeah.
And you know, I don't think I'm underestimating my fellow citizens. I don't know that when they go to the supermarket and look up for, you know, what's on special this week, or do they like this brand of toothpaste or that brand of toothpaste, that they ever really think what it's like to have a life where you don't have any choice. In fact, you're quite lucky if you have toothpaste, but you don't have a choice in terms of soap or a whole range of other things. And the importance and independence and sense of self that you can get by making choices, and what damage you do to lives when you don't let people have any choices. Do you think people in Oxford think of that? How lucky they are to be able to choose their toothpaste?
No, I'm sure they don't. You know, we've got the supermarket across the road here where you've maybe got probably 15 different toothpastes you can choose from. Never mind, often no choice at all in these places. But what has changed, certainly in, I'd say in the last 10 or 5 years in the refugee camps is there is much more of a sense driven by the UN that people want to be able to choose what they spend their aid money on. So the refugees, if they're going to, instead of getting a bag of maize and a packet of sugar and a bottle of oil each month for their family, they will be given a voucher for, I don't know, $50 or $30 or $100 or whatever it may be, depending on how big their family is. And they can then go and spend that voucher at a small store or small supermarket on the goods which they think their family most needs. And I think that is definitely a good thing, both
Heaps better. Yeah, it saves the logistics of getting the maize there or whatever.
Exactly.
All the people employed to do that. There might be some employment in terms of vouchers and the monitoring of them because that's just cash. So that all has to have some staffing around it. I understand that. But it must be simpler than hauling goods around the country to meet, you know, use-by dates and that sort of stuff, than giving people the money and saying, in voucher form, why don't you buy what you like instead of what we think? Sounds heaps better to me.
Yeah, I think there's a consensus, not just within the UN, but I think with donor governments around the world, that this is the way forward. I know the British government, through the Department for International Development, they are quite big on giving cash rather than giving food as aid and letting people make their own choices, which then stimulates the local economy and encourages entrepreneurship and all that sort of thing. So, yeah, that's happening.
Sure. You know, in a previous life, I had something to do with the World Food Programme. And I know that Australians sometimes say, oh, why can't we give them wheat? You know, there are circumstances in which giving wheat is just not helpful. Like try a flooded island or a flood anywhere, you know. Wheat's not much job if you can't get around to, you know, do what you need to do with it. So giving people what they need, that's real aid. Anyway, I have to say, Zahn Rice, it's been a pleasure. Thanks for joining us and thanks for helping us cast a light on the entrepreneurial spirit that exists in these camps, that people aren't just sitting there with a handout. They're getting off their backside and doing things.
Thank you. Thanks very much for having me on.